The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the October 28, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read an article about how a new book recalibrates our understanding of the genius of Thomas Edison. And then, from the November 4, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read an article about why we can't tell the truth about old age. I'll begin today with a poem from the November 4th edition of the New Yorker magazine. The poem is entitled "Failed Essay on Privilege" by Alyssa Gonzalez. I came from something popularly known as nothing, and in the coming I got a lot. My parents didn't speak money, didn't speak college. Still, I went to Yale. For a while, I tried to condemn. I wrote, "Let me introduce you to evil." Still, I was a guest there. I made myself at home. And I know a fine shoe when I see one. And I know to be sincerely sorry for those people's problems. I know to want nothing more than it would be so nice to have. And I confess I'll never hate what I've been given as much as I wish I could. Still, I thought I, of all people, understood Aristotle, what is and isn't the good life. Because I wrote, privilege is an aggressive form of amnesia. I left a house with no heat. I left the habit of hunger. I left the room I shared with seven brothers and sisters I also left. Even the good is regrettable, or at least sometimes should be regretted. Yet to hate myself is not to absolve her. I paid so much for wisdom. And look at all of this. Look at all I have. And now, from the critics section of the October 28th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, an essay entitled "The Perfector" by Casey Sepp. There were ideas long before there were light bulbs, but of all the ideas that have ever turned into inventions, only the light bulb became a symbol of ideas. Earlier innovations had literalized the experience of seeing the light, but no one went around talking about torchlight moments or sketching candles into cartoon thought bubbles. What made the light bulb such an irresistible image for ideas was not just the invention, but its inventor. Thomas Edison was already well known by the time he perfected the long-burning incandescent light bulb. But he was photographed next to one of them so often that the public came to associate the bulbs with invention itself. That made sense by a kind of transitive property of ingenuity. During his lifetime, Edison patented a record-setting 1,093 different inventions. On a single day in 1888, he wrote down 112 ideas. Averaged across his adult life, he patented something roughly every 11 days. There was the light bulb and the phonograph, of course, but also the kinetoscope, the dictating machine, the alkaline battery, and the electric meter, plus a sap extractor, a talking doll, the world's largest rock crusher, an electric pen, a fruit preserver, and a tornado-proof house. Not all of these inventions worked or made money. Edison never got anywhere with his ink for the blind, whatever that was meant to be. His concrete furniture, though durable, was doomed, and his failed innovations in mining lost him several fortunes. but he founded more than 100 companies and employed thousands of assistants, engineers, machinists, and researchers. At the time of his death, according to one estimate, about $15 billion of the national economy derived from his inventions alone. He was a household name, not least because his name was in every household, plastered on the appliances, devices, and products that defined modernity for so many families. Edison's detractors insist that his greatest invention was his own fame, cultivated at the expense of collaborators and competitors alike. His defenders counter that his celebrity was commensurate with his brilliance. Even some of his admirers, though, have misunderstood his particular form of inventiveness, which was never about creating something out of nothing. The real nature of his genius is clarified in Edison, published by Random House, a new biography by Edmund Morris, a writer who famously struggled with just how inventive a biographer should be. Lauded for his trilogy of books about Theodore Roosevelt, Morris was scolded for his peculiar book about Ronald Reagan. Edison may have figured out how to illuminate the world, but Morris makes us wonder how best to illuminate a life. Edison did not actually invent the light bulb, of course. People have been making wires in Condes since 1761, and plenty of other inventors had demonstrated and even patented various versions of incandescent lights by 1878, when Edison turned his attention to the problem of illumination. Edison's gift, here and elsewhere, was not so much inventing as what he called perfecting, finding ways to make things better or cheaper, or both. Edison did not look for problems in need of solutions. He looked for solutions in need of modification. Born in 1847 in Ohio and raised in Michigan, Edison had been experimenting since childhood when he built a chemistry laboratory in his family's basement. That early endeavor only ever earned him the ire of his mother, who fretted about explosions, so, at 13, the young entrepreneur started selling snacks to passengers traveling on the local railroad line from Port Huron to Detroit. He also picked up copies of the Detroit Free Press to hawk on the way home. In 1862, after the Battle of Shiloh, he bought 1,000 copies, knowing he would sell them all, and marked up the price more and more the farther he got down the line. While still in his teens, he bought a portable letterpress and started printing his own newspaper aboard the moving train, filling two sides of a broadsheet with local sundries. Its circulation rose to 400 a week, and Edison took over much of the baggage car. He built a small chemistry laboratory there, too. One day, Edison saw a station master's young son playing on the tracks and pulled the boy to safety before an oncoming train crushed him. As a reward, the father taught Edison Morse code and showed him how to operate the telegraph machines. This came in handy that summer when Edison's lab caused a fire and the conductor kicked him off the train. Forced out of newspapering, Edison spent the next few years as a telegrapher for Western Union and other companies, taking jobs wherever he could find them, Indiana, Ohio, Tennessee, Kentucky. He had time to experiment on the side, and he patented his first invention in 1869, an electric vote recorder that eliminated the need for roll call by instantly tallying votes. It worked so well that no legislative body wanted it, because it left no time for lobbying amid the yeas and the nays. That failure cured Edison of any interest in invention for invention's sake. From then on, he cultivated a taste for the practical and the profitable. Although legislatures did not want their votes counted faster, everyone else wanted everything else to move as quickly as possible. Financial companies, for instance, wanted their stock information immediately, and communication companies wanted to speed up their telegram service. Edison's first lucrative products were a stock ticker device, and a quadruplex telegraph capable of sending four messages at once. Armed with those inventions, he found financial support for his telegraphy research, and used money from Western Union to buy an abandoned building in New Jersey to serve as a workshop. In 1875, having outgrown that site, he bought 30 acres not far from Newark and began converting the property into what he liked to call his invention factory. It was organized around a two-story laboratory with chemistry experiments on the top floor and a machine shop below. Workshops are at least as old as Hephaestus, but Edison's was the world's first research and development facility, a model that would later be adopted by governments, universities, and rival corporations. Menlo Park, as it came to be known, was arguably Edison's most significant invention, since it facilitated so many others, by allowing for the division of problems into discrete chemical, electrical, and physical components, which teams of workers could solve through theory and then experimentation before moving directly into production. Menlo Park also included a three-story house for Edison's family. In 1871, when he was 24, he married a 16-year-old girl named Mary Stillwell, who had taken refuge in his office during a rainstorm. They had three children, two of whom Edison nicknamed Dot and Dash. It is likely thanks to them that the first audio recording ever made in November of 1877 features Papa Edison reciting, "Mary Had a Little Lamb." The phonograph came about because Edison had been experimenting with telephones, trying to improve on Alexander Graham Bell's transmitter to achieve better sound quality across longer distances. He first had in mind a kind of answering machine that would transcribe the contents of a call, but he quickly realized that it might be possible to record the voice itself. To test the idea, Edison spoke into a diaphragm with a needle attached. As he spoke, the needle vibrated across a piece of paraffin paper, carving into it the ups and downs of the sound waves. To everyone's surprise, the design worked. When he added a second needle to retrace the marks in the paper, the vibrating diaphragm reproduced Edison's voice. So novel was the talking machine that many people refused to believe in its existence. Understandably, since up to that point in history, sound had been entirely ephemeral. But once they heard it with their own ears, they all wanted one, and scores of new inventors opened their pockets to help Edison meet the demand. With this infusion of cash, Edison was able to hire dozens of new muckers, as the men who worked with him would eventually become known. The endearment may have taken hold during his ill-fated mining days. Muck is a term for ore, which his men tried and failed to remove from mines more efficiently. This was the team that banished the darkness, or at least made it subject to a switch. By the 1870s, plenty of homes were lit with indoor gas lamps, but they produced terrible fumes and covered everything in soot. Arc lights, which buzz like welder's torches in a few cities around the world, were, in the words of Robert Louis Stevenson, horrible, unearthly, obnoxious to the human eye, a lamp for a nightmare. What Edison and his muckers did was figure out a way to regulate incandescent light, making the bulbs burn longer and more reliably, and at a more bearable brightness. The filament was the trickiest part, and he and his team tried hundreds of materials before settling on carbon, which they got to burn for 14.5 hours in the fall of 1879. A year later, when they tried carbonized bamboo, it burned for more than 1,000 hours. By the new year, individual light bulbs had given way to a network of illumination around Menlo Park, which became known as the Village of Light. Gawkers came every night to see the apricot smudges of light through the windows of Edison's house and along the streets, marveling at how the bulbs stayed lit through wind and rain, shining steadily and silently, and could be turned off and on with ease. The world was still measured in candle power, and each bulb had the brightness of 16 candles. Menlo Park had been barely a stop on the railway line when Edison first moved there. Now, in a single day, hundreds of passengers would empty from the trains to see the laboratory that made night look like noon. Edison's patent attorney worried about the publicity, especially when the likes of George Westinghouse and Edward Weston came calling. But by February 1880, Edison had executed patent number 223,898 for the electric lamp and number 369,280 for a system of electrical distribution. He put both to use in winning a contract to electrify part of New York City and built a generating plant on Pearl Street that eventually served more than 900 customers. While supervising the construction of the plant, Edison moved his family to Gramercy Park. Then, in August 1884, Mary died suddenly, officially from congestion of the brain, though possibly of a morphine overdose. She was 29. After her death, Edison left Menlo Park for good. One long season of grief, and 2 years later, he married Mina Miller, the 20-year-old daughter of one of the founders of the Chautauqua Institution. She and Edison had three children of their own, and the family moved to West Orange, New Jersey, where Edison built another laboratory. This new complex improved on the already astounding pace of invention at Menlo Park and greatly expanded Edison's manufacturing capacity. "I will have the best equipped and largest laboratory extent, he bragged in a letter, "and the facilities incomparably superior to any other for rapid and cheap development of an invention." He wanted to be able to build anything from a lady's watch to a locomotive. And employees were soon working in separate teams on alkaline batteries, sound recordings, fluoroscopes for medical radiography, a device that measured infrared radiation, motion picture cameras and projectors and the pictures themselves, and anything else that Edison thought he could market. Like tech CEOs today, Edison attracted an enormous following, both because his inventions fundamentally altered the texture of daily life, and because he nurtured a media scrum that fawned over every inch of his laboratory and fixated on every minute of his day. Newspapers covered his inventions months and sometimes years before they were functional, and journalist after journalist conspired with him for better coverage. One writer even arranged to co-author a sci-fi novel with him. A recent book by Jeff Gwynn, The Vagabonds, published by Simon & Schuster, chronicles the publicity-seeking road trips that Edison took with Harvey Firestone and Henry Ford every summer from 1914 to 1924, driving a caravan of cars around the country, promoting themselves as much as the automobiles. Edison's life had already been thoroughly documented for the public. The first authorized biography, two full volumes worth, appeared in 1910. All the way up to his death, 21 years later, at the age of 84, Edison was still making headlines, even if, by then, his rate of perfecting had finally slowed. How many biographers does it take to change a light bulb? Who knows, but it takes only one to change a narrative. Every decade or so, for a century now, a new book about Edison has appeared, promising to explain his genius or, more recently, to explain it away. In the earliest years after his death, those biographies expanded on Edison's personality, revealing the complexities of his family life and his work habit. He adhered, readers learned, to the prescriptions of a 16th-century Venetian crank named Luigi Cornario, drinking pints of warm milk every few hours and consuming no more than 6 ounces of solid food per meal. He worked 50 hours at a time, and sometimes longer, including one stretch of 4 consecutive days, taking irregular naps wherever he happened to be, including once in the presence of President Warren Harding. His eating was disordered, his moods disastrous. He was affectionate but absent-minded with both of his wives and emotionally abusive with his children, one of whom, Thomas Jr., he sued in order to stop him from selling snake oil under the family name. Edison left behind millions of pages of notes and diaries and reports, providing one biographer after another with new source material to draw on. Then, a dozen years ago, Randall Strauss, who has written extensively about Silicon Valley, published The Wizard of Menlo Park, How Thomas Alva Edison Invented the Modern World. Despite its admiring subtitle, Strauss's book sought to reveal the man behind the curtain. In his view, a humbug whose bigotry and bad business sense were salvaged only by the creativity, savvy, and cowardice of his munchkins, who toiled away on invention after invention for which their wizard took credit. That kind of correction was surely inevitable, given Edison's status and the culture's increasing skepticism about great men and their ostensible genius. Although Strauss's book was not the first to consider Edison's faults, when Wachhorst probed his self-promotion in Thomas Alva Edison, An American Myth, from 1981, and Paul Israel cataloged his belief in racial stereotypes and phrenological theories in Edison, A Life of Invention, from 1998. Strauss portrays Edison as a patent-hungry P.T. Barnum, or perhaps a proto-Elizabeth Holmes. But that argument is not entirely convincing. Edison's hype was not for its own sake. It was to raise capital, which he rarely held on to for long, partly because he was never much of a businessman, and partly because he only wanted more of it in order to keep working. Nor were his inventions fake, even if they were sometimes impractical or borrowed from other people. And he didn't hide the borrowing. Like Santa's elves, the muckers were always a part of the mythology. So, too, was the drudgery. Edison not only rhymed perspiration with inspiration, he also talked endlessly about his experiments and trials, emphasizing just how much work went into every discovery. Unlike his one-time employee and sometime rival, Nikola Tesla, Edison insisted that answers came not from his mind, but from his laboratory. "I never had an idea in my life," he once said. "My so-called inventions already existed in the environment. I took them out. I've created nothing. Nobody does. There's no such thing as an idea being brain-born. Everything comes from the outside." In that conviction, Edison was perhaps ahead of his time. 3 decades after Edison died, the sociologist Robert K. Merton put forward a theory concerning simultaneous invention, or what he called multiple discoveries. Think of Newton and Leibniz coming up with calculus independently but concurrently, or Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace thinking their way to natural selection at nearly the same time. Or inventors in Spain, Italy, and Britain sorting out steam engines within a few decades of one another. In Merton's terms, multiples are more common than singletons, which is to say that discovery and invention are rarely the product of only one person. The problems of the age attract the problem solvers of the age, all of whom work more or less within the same constraints and avail themselves of the same existing theories and technologies. Merton provides a useful context for Edison, who, as he himself knew, was never inventing ex nihilo. Rather, he was nipping at the heels of other inventors while trying to stay ahead of the ones at his. It may be satisfying to talk of Alexander Graham Bell inventing the telephone, but Elisha Gray filed a patent for one on the same day, and Edison improved on both of their designs. Similarly, we may safely refer to Edison as the inventor of the phonograph, but his failure to recognize the demand for lower quality, more affordable audio recordings meant that he quickly lost the market to the makers of the Victrola. Strauss makes much of that failure in his biography, but consumer markets are hardly the only and rarely the best measure of genius, a point made clear, and painfully so, by Edison's preference for and optimism about electric cars. It seems odd to judge Edison negatively for making fuel cells before their time, or for trying to find a viable domestic source for rubber, even if, on those fronts, he never succeeded. The delight of Edmund Morris's Edison is that, instead of arguing with earlier writers or debating the terms of genius, it focuses on the phenomenological impact of Edison's work. He tries to return readers to the technological revolutions of the past, to capture how magical this wizard's work really felt. He reminds us that there was a time when a 5-second kinetoscopic record of a man sneezing was just about the most astonishing thing anyone had ever seen. People watched it over and over again, like a 19th century TikTok. And he makes plain the cosmological significance of Edison's phonograph, how, against all understandings of human impermanence, it allowed the dead to go on speaking forever. "Here now were echoes made hard," Morris writes, "resounding as often as anyone wanted to hear them." Allowing the dead to speak is also what biographies do, and Edison does it doubly because it is the last book that Morris finished before his death earlier this year at age 78. Morris's first book, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, won both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize after it was published in 1979. But it was his second book that really caused a stir. The success of Morris's Roosevelt biography was shortly followed by the election of Ronald Reagan, and after the inauguration, the new administration courted him to be the president's official scribe. Morris spent 14 years working on a book that he ultimately published under the confused title of Dutch, a memoir of Ronald Reagan. Devoured by the public and scorned by the academy, debated by the Boswells of the world, the book featured a fictional narrator who claimed to have known the 40th president since they were teenagers. To support the narrative voice, Morris created additional characters, staged scenes that never happened, and fabricated footnotes to corroborate the counterfeited material. It was easy to assume that the invented voice belonged to Morris himself, since the eye of the book expresses frustration about holding off on a planned trilogy on Teddy Roosevelt in order to write about Dutch Reagan. But many of the details contradicted those of Morris's own life. When critics assailed his approach, Morris defended himself on the ground that he had found Reagan too boring for a standard biography, and then later claimed that his performance style had been mimetic of his subject, a performer whose entire presidency, he suggested, had been an act. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with an artist of the court adding himself to the portrait, as Diego Velázquez did in Las Meninas. Morris's transgressions lay first in making things up, and second in failing to disclose what he was doing. His critics found those actions disqualifying in a biography. His champions found Dutch formally innovative. Some argued that, to one extent or another, all biography is just historical fiction in more respectable packaging. There is a faint echo of that formal tomfoolery in Edison, which begins with the inventor's death and then takes a turn for the Benjamin Button. Morris moves backward through the decades of Edison's life. Like Merlin, this wizard ages in reverse. Life within each section is still lived forward. Part 1 starts in 1920 and runs until 1929. Part 2 goes from 1910 to 1919, and so on. The whole thing has the halting feel of two steps forward, one step back. Edison has a second wife before we ever learn what happened to the first. Menlo Park has already been disassembled and recreated as a museum in Michigan before we get the story of its founding in New Jersey. The inventor is completely deaf in one ear and half deaf in the other for 600 pages before we find out that he lost most of his hearing by age 12 from an unknown cause. Reverse chronologies might work well in fictions like Christopher Nolan's Memento or Harold Pinter's Betrayal, where they are serving grander themes of the fragility of memory and the failures of fidelity, but they are an unsatisfying solution to the problem of how to structure a biography. Morris gestures toward a better one by titling each section with a discipline in which Edison distinguished himself. Each backward-marching decade is matched to botany, defense, chemistry, magnetism, light, sound, telegraphy, or natural philosophy. Tracing someone's intellectual interests across a lifetime can be more meaningful than dragging the subject and the reader ever onward through calendrical time. But a backward biography, which certainly is an invention, Edison might have pointed out, is neither practical nor profitable. Even if you make your peace with this reverse narration, which, to be honest, I did, partly because Edison feels so much like a time traveler, Edison is still a frustrating book. It contains little new material, good prose, but far too much of it, and no novel argument or fresh angle to motivate such an exhaustive return to an already storied life. If anything, Morris offers the same strange apologia for Edison that he did for Dutch. Nobody around him understood him, Morris said of Reagan. Every person I interviewed, almost without exception, eventually would say, "You know, I could never really figure him out." In the same vein, Morris once compared Edison to electricity itself, an invisible force seen only when it acts on the world around it. What he was in person is harder, maybe impossible to say, Morris concluded, because he put so much of himself into his work. And yet, figuring people out is the fundamental task of the biographer. Every person is elusive in one way or another, sometimes even unto herself. But it is possible to confront those inner mysteries in a biography without resorting to fabrications or gimmicks. It's a lesson Morris could have learned from Edison. Sometimes what's called for isn't invention, but perfection. And now, from a critic at large section of the November 4th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Old News, Why Can't We Tell the Truth About Aging? By Arthur Crystal. In days of old, when most people didn't live to be old, there were very few notable works about old age, and those were penned by writers who were themselves not very old. Chaucer was around 50 when The Merchant's Tale was conceived. Shakespeare either 41 or 42 when he wrote King Lear. Swift, 55 or so, when gleefully depicting the immortal but ailing Struldbrugs, and Tennyson, a mere 24 when he began Tithonus and completed Ulysses, his great anthem to an aging but hungry heart. One might think that 40 was not so young in Shakespeare's day, but if you survived birth, infections, wars, and pestilence, you stood a decent chance of reaching an advanced age, no matter when you were born. Average life expectancy was indeed a sorry number for the greater part of history. For Americans born as late as 1900, it wasn't even 50. Which may be one reason that people didn't write books about aging. There weren't enough old folks around to sample them. But now that more people on the planet are over 65 than under 5, An army of readers stands waiting to learn what old age has in store. Reading through a recent spate of books that deal with aging, one might forget that half a century ago, the elderly were, as V.S. Pritchett noted in his 1964 introduction to Muriel Spark's novel Memento Mori, the great suppressed and censored subject of a contemporary society, the one we do not care to face. Not only are we facing it today, we are also putting the best face on it that we possibly can. Our senior years are evidently a time to celebrate ourselves and the wonderful things to come. Traveling, volunteering, canoodling, acquiring new skills, and so on. No one, it seems, wants to disparage old age. Nora Ephron's I Feel Bad About My Neck tries, but it is too wittily mournful to have real angst. Instead, we get such cheerful tidings as Mary Pfeiffer's Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. Mark E. Agronin's The End of Old Age, Living a Longer, More Purposeful Life. Alan D. Castell's Better with Age, The Psychology of Successful Aging. Ashton Applewhite's This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. And Carl Honoré's Bolder, Making the Most of Our Longer Lives. Five chatty accounts meant to reassure us that getting old just means that we have to work harder at staying young. Pfeiffer is a clinical psychologist who is attentive to women over 60, whose minds and bodies, she asserts, are steadily being devalued. She is sometimes tiresomely trite, urging women to conceptualize all experiences in positive ways, but invariably sympathetic. Agronin described, perhaps confusingly, as a geriatric psychiatrist, he's in his mid-50s, believes that aging not only brings strength, but is also the most profound thing we accomplish in life. Castell, a professor of psychology at UCLA, believes in successful aging and seeks to show us how it can be achieved. And Applewhite, who calls herself an author and activist, doesn't just inveigh against stereotypes, she wants to nuke them, replacing terms like seniors and the elderly with olders. Olders, she believes, can get down with the best of them. Retirement homes are, quote, hotbeds of lust and romance, she writes. Quote, sex and arousal do change, but often for the better, end quote. Could be, though I've never heard anyone testify to this, perhaps the Epicurean philosopher Rodney Dangerfield, who died a month short of his 83rd birthday, having studied the relationship between sexuality and longevity, said it best. Quote, I'm at the age where food has taken the place of sex in my life. In fact, I've just had a mirror put over my kitchen table. End quote. Applewhite makes an appearance in Honoré's book. She tells Honoré, a Canadian journalist who is now 51, that aging is like falling in love or motherhood. Honoré reminds us that history is full of folks smashing it in later life. Smashers include Sophocles, Michelangelo, Rembrandt, Bach, and Edison, who filed patents into his 80s. Perhaps because Honoré isn't an American, he omits Satchel Paige, who pitched in the majors until he was 59. Like Applewhite, who claims that the older brain works in a more synchronized way, Honoré contends that aging may alter the structure of the brain in ways that boost creativity. These authors aren't blind to the perils of aging. They just prefer to see the upside. All maintain that seniors are more comfortable in their own skins. Experience, Applewhite says, less social anxiety, and fewer social phobias. And there's some evidence for this. The connection between happiness and aging, following the success of books like Jonathan Rauch's The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50, and John Leyland's Happiness is a Choice You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old, both published last year, has nearly come to be accepted as fact. According to a 2011 Gallup survey, happiness shows the U-shaped curve first proposed in a 2008 study by the economists David Blanchflower and Andrew Oswald. They found that people's sense of well-being was highest in childhood and old age, with a perceptible dip around midlife. Lately, however, the curve has invited skepticism. Apparently, its trajectory holds true mainly in countries where the median wage is high and people tend to live longer, or, alternatively, where the poor feel resentment more keenly during middle age and don't mind saying so. But there may be a simpler explanation. Perhaps the people who participate in such surveys are those whose lives tend to follow the curve, while people who feel miserable at 70 or 80, whose ennui is offset only by brooding over unrealized expectations, don't even bother to open such questionnaires. One strategy of these books is to emphasize that aging is natural and therefore good, an idea that harks back to Plato, who lived to be around 80 and thought philosophy best suited to men of more mature years. Women, no matter their age, could not think metaphysically. His most famous student, Aristotle, had a different opinion. His Ars Rhetorica contains long passages denouncing old men as miserly, cowardly, cynical, loquacious, and temperamentally chilly. Aristotle thought that the body lost heat as it aged. These gruff views were formed during the first part of Aristotle's life, and we don't know if they changed before he died at the age of 62. The nature is always right argument found its most eloquent spokesman in the Roman statesman Cicero, who was 62 when he wrote De Senectute, liberally translated as How to Grow Old, a valiant performance that both John Adams, dead at 90, and Benjamin Franklin, dead at 84, thought highly of. Montaigne took a more measured view. Writing around 1580, he considered the end of long life to be rare, extraordinarily, and singular. 'Tis the less and extremest sort of dying, and the more remote, the less to be hoped for. Montaigne, who never reached 60, might have changed his mind upon learning that in the 21st century, people routinely live into their 70s and 80s. But I suspect that he'd still say, whoever saw old age that did not applaud the past and condemn the present times? No happiness curve for him. There is, of course, a chance that you may be happier at 80 than you were at 20 or 40, but you're going to feel much worse. I know this because two recent books provide a sobering look at what happens to the human body as the years pile up. Elizabeth Blackburn and Alyssa Eeples' The Telomere Effect, Living Younger, Healthier, Longer, and Sue Armstrong's Borrowed Time, The Science of How and Why We Age, describe what is essentially a messy business. Armstrong, a British science and health writer, presents, in crack Michael Lewis style, the high points of aging research, along with capsule biographies of the main players. While Blackburn, one of the three recipients of the 2009 Nobel Prize in Physiology, focuses on the shortening of telomeres, those tiny agelets of DNA attached to our chromosomes, whose length is a measure of cellular health. Basically, most cells divide and replicate some 50 times or more before becoming senescent. Not nearly as inactive as the name suggests, senescent cells contribute to chronic inflammation and interfere with protective collagens. Meanwhile, telomeres shorten with each cell division, even as lifestyle affects the degree of shrinkage. Data now suggests that married people or people living with a partner have longer telomeres. Walt Whitman, who never married, made it to 72 and offered a lyric case for aging. Youth, large, lusty, loving, youth full of grace, force, fascination, he intoned. Do you know that old age may come after you with equal grace, force, fascination? It's pretty to think so, but the biology suggests otherwise. The so-called epigenetic clock shows our DNA getting gummed up, age-related mitochondrial mutations reducing the cell's ability to generate energy, and our immune system slowly growing less efficient. Bones weaken, eyes strain, hearts flag, bladders empty too often, bowels not often enough, and toxic proteins build up in the brain to form the plaque and the spaghetti-like tangles that are associated with Alzheimer's disease. Not surprisingly, 68% of Medicare beneficiaries today have multiple chronic conditions. Not a lot of grace, force, or fascination in that. In short, the optimistic narrative of pro-aging writers doesn't line up with the dark story told by the human body. But maybe that's not the point. There is only one solution if old age is not to be an absurd parody of our former life, Simone de Beauvoir wrote in her expansive 1970 study, The Coming of Age. And that is to go on pursuing ends that give our existence a meaning, devotion to individuals, to groups, or to causes, social, political, intellectual, or creative work. But such meaning is not easily gained. In 1975, Robert Neil Butler, who had previously coined the term ageism, published Why Survive? Being Old in America, a Pulitzer Prize-winning study of society's dereliction toward the nation's aging population. For many elderly Americans, old age is a tragedy, a period of quiet despair, deprivation, desolation, and muted rage, he concluded. The literature on old age has grown so voluminous that the 50 million Americans over the age of 65 could spend the rest of their lives reading such books, even as lusty retirees and powerlifting septuagenarians turn out new ones. The most recent grand philosophical overview of aging is also by a woman, and lighting upon Helen Small's The Long Life is like entering the University of Old Age after matriculating at a perfectly good college. Small, an Oxford don, and just 42 when the book came out, wants to integrate old age into how we think about life. Pondering what it means to be someone who has completed a life cycle that Montaigne thought unnatural, she considered old age to be connected into larger philosophical considerations, whose depiction, whether literary or scientific, both drives and reflects emotional and ethical attitudes. And echoing the philosopher Bernard Williams, she suggests that our lives accrue meaning over time, and therefore the story of the self is not complete until it experiences old age, the stage of life that helps us grasp who we are and what our life has meant. Not everyone wants to find out if Small's equation between old age and self-knowledge holds up. In 2014, The Atlantic ran an essay by the oncologist and bioethicist Ezekiel J. Emanuel, then 57, whose title alone, Why I Hope to Die at 75, caused uneasy shuffling among 70-year-olds. Emanuel believes that by the time he hits this milestone, he will have lived a full life. He argues that by 75, creativity, originality, and productivity are pretty much gone for the vast, vast majority of us. Unlike Honoré and Applewhite, Emmanuel thinks that it is difficult, if not impossible, to generate new, creative thoughts because we don't develop a new set of neural connections that can supersede the existing network. Although he doesn't plan on suicide, he won't actively prolong his life. No more cancer screening tests, colonoscopies, and the like. No pacemaker or stents. He wants to get out while the getting is good. It's an unselfish outlook, but not quite credible to unevolved people like me. Having entered my 70s, I don't care that I may not have much to contribute after I'm 75. I'm not sure I'll have that much to contribute before turning 75. Let's grant that there are as many ways to grow old as there are people going about it, especially since More of us keep chugging along despite our aches and ailments. If I'd known I was going to live this long, said Mickey Mantle, or possibly Mae West, or UB Blake, I would have taken better care of myself. Mantle was only 63 when he died. But the truth is that many of us are going to be physically better off at 80 than Shakespeare's Jacques could have imagined. Avec teeth, avec sight, avec hearing, which is to say dental implants, glasses, and hearing aids, a long life is a gift. But I'm not sure we're going to be grateful for it. Normal aging is bad enough, but things become dire if dementia develops, the chances of which double every 5 years past the age of 65. Applewhite, however, citing recent research, no longer thinks that dementia is inevitable or even likely. May she live long and prosper, but for those of us who have cared for spouse or parents with dementia, it's not always a simple matter to know on whom the burden falls the heaviest. 1 in 3 caregivers is 65 or older. Obviously, I'm not a candidate for the Old Person's Hall of Fame. Yes, we should live as long as possible, barring illness and infirmity, but when it comes to depredations of age, let's not lose candor along with muscle tone. The goal, you could say, is to live long enough to think, I've lived long enough. One would, of course, like to approach old age with grace and fortitude, but old age makes it difficult. Those who feel that it's a welcome respite from the passions, anxieties, and troubles of youth or middle age are either very lucky or toweringly reasonable. Why rail against the inevitable? What good will it do? None at all. Complaining is both pointless and unseemly. Existence itself may be pointless and unseemly. No wonder we wonder at the meaning of it all. At first we want life to be romantic, later to be bearable, finally to be understandable, Louise Bogan wrote. Professor Small would agree, and though I am a fan of her book, I have my doubts about whether the piling on of years really does add to our understanding of life. Doesn't Reagan say of her raging royal father, 'Tis the infirmity of his age, yet he hath ever but slenderly known himself. The years may have broadened experience and tempt perspective, but is wisdom or contentment certain to follow? A contented old age probably depends on what we were like before we became old. Vain, self-centered people will likely find aging less tolerable than those who seek meaning in life by helping others. And those fortunate enough to have lived a full and productive life may exit without undue regret. But if you're someone who, oh, for the sake of argument, is unpleasantly surprised that people in their 40s or 50s give you a seat on the bus, or that your doctors are 40 years younger than you are, you just might resent time's insistent drumbeat. Sure, there's life in the old boy yet, but certain restrictions apply. The body, tired, aching, shrinking, now quite often embarrasses us. Many older men have to pee right after they pee, and many older women pee whenever they sneeze. Pfeiffer and company might simply say, Gesundheit, and urge us on. Life, they insist, doesn't necessarily get worse after 70 or 80. But it does, you know. I don't care how many seniors are loosening their bedsprings every night, something is missing. It's not just energy or sexual prowess, but the thrill of anticipation. Even if you're single, can you ever again feel the rush of excitement that comes with the first brush of the lips, the first moment when clothes drop to the floor? Who the hell wants to tear his or her clothes off at 75? Now we dim the lights and fold our slacks and hope we don't look too soft, too wrinkled, too old. Yes, mature love allows for physical imperfections, but wouldn't we rather be desired for our beauty than forgiven for our flaws? These may seem like shallow regrets, and yet the loss of pleasure in one's own body, the loss of pleasure in knowing that one's body pleases others, is a real one. I can already hear the objections. If my children are grown and happy, if my grandchildren light up when they see me, if I'm healthy and financially secure, if I'm reasonably satisfied with what I've accomplished, if I feel more comfortable now that I have no longer have to prove myself, why then the loss of youth is a fair trade-off? Those are a lot of ifs, but never mind. We should all make peace with aging. And so my hat is off to Dr. Oliver Sacks, who chose to regard old age as a time of leisure and freedom, freed from the factitious urgencies of earlier days, free to explore whatever I wish, and to bind the thoughts and feelings of a lifetime together. At 82, he rediscovered the joy of gefilte fish, which, as he noted, would usher him out of life as it had ushered him into it. No wise man ever wished to be younger, Swift asserted, never having met me. But this doesn't mean that we have to see old age as something other than what it is. It may complete us, but in doing so, defeats us. Life is slow dying, Philip Larkin wrote before he stopped dying at 63, a truth that young people who are too busy living cavalierly ignore. Should it give them pause, they'll discover that just about every book on the subject advocates a positive attitude toward aging in order to maintain a sense of satisfaction and to achieve a measure of wisdom. And yet, it seems to me that a person can be both wise and unhappy, wise and regretful, and even wise and dubious about the wisdom of growing old. When Socrates declared that philosophy is the practice of dying, he was saying that the thought itself is shaped by mortality, and it's because our existence is limited that we're able to think past those limits. Time has us in its grip, and so we devise stories of an afterlife in which we exist unshackled by days and years and the decay they represent. But where does that get us, beyond the vague suspicion that immortality, at least in the shape of the vengeful Yahweh or the spiteful Greek and Roman gods, is no guarantee of wisdom? But what do I know? I'm just one person who at 71 doesn't feel as good as he did at 61, and who is fairly certain that he's going to feel even worse at 81. I simply know what men and women have always known. Our generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. If only the writer had stopped there. Unfortunately, he went on to add, in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. The fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? This too is meaningless. No young person could have written that. We've run out of time for today's broadcast. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New York readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.